Today we're in chapter 8, mostly in chapter 9. Starting in chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes, verse 16, and going on through most of chapter 9. The book of Ecclesiastes is the exact opposite of most modern self-help books. Most modern self-help books are devoted to saying to you, you can do this, you can do that. Try hard enough, just apply yourself in the right way, think positively, and you'll succeed. In the book of Ecclesiastes, we have read over and over, you can't do anything. You can't guarantee your own success. Everything is in the hand of God. All you can do is trust in Him and enjoy what He gives you moment by moment. It couldn't be a sharper contrast to the wisdom of our age, the wisdom of our day, than there is in the teaching of this book. And we'll see that today in particular. The three pieces that we want to try to cover today. In the first, which is 8:16 to 9:1, we learn that man cannot know. He can't figure out what's going on in this world that God has placed him in. And then we go from 9:2 down to about verse 12. And that tells us that man cannot do. That all of man's efforts to accomplish things are bounded by what Mr. Preacher calls time and chance. We don't control the world we live in. And so we're limited in what we can accomplish. Then down here, 13 to 18, there's a transition to next week. And it's an important transition for us to recognize, because all of chapter 9 is saying wisdom isn't going to get you anywhere. But then in chapter 10, we're going to read about the benefits of wisdom and how worthless folly is. Now that sounds sort of contradictory. On the one hand, we say, well, you can be wise and it won't help you. But then we turn around and we're going to say in chapter 10 that wisdom is great and folly is terrible. The difference is that wisdom often helps people, but you can't guarantee that it will help the person who has it. And so we have a little story here, chapter 9, verses 13 to 18, to show us that while wisdom is beneficial, and it does help, there's no guarantee that the wise man himself will be the one who profits from it. In fact, the wise man may end up with the short end of the stick. So, let's begin at chapter 8, verses 16 through 9:1. Where we're going to learn that man cannot know. 8:16. When I applied mine heart to know wisdom, and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because, though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. For all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred. And then if you leave out the italics in that last phrase, you get the expression, all is before them. The big point here is in the middle, beginning of verse 17. I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. That's the theme idea here. Man cannot know. He cannot understand what's going on in the world. Do you feel confused by current events? Do you feel confused by what's going on around you? So did Mr. Preacher. And he's writing here, oh my goodness, As long as 3,000 years ago. These are sentiments of King Solomon. He lived about 1,000 years before Christ. Nothing's changed. We think our world is so complicated and so hard to understand. It was just as complicated and just as hard to understand back then. Man cannot know. Man cannot understand. Mr. Preacher sets his investigation out in verse 16. I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth. He sets his heart to understand these two things, wisdom and what he calls business, which we could spell this way, busyness. When he talks about business, what he means is busyness. This is the word that's elsewhere translated travail in the book. He wants to understand all the labor that people go through And just to make clear that that's what he's talking about, he adds, you know, there are these people that neither day nor night see sleep with their eyes. You think of the college student pulling an all-nighter. Well, there are people that just drive themselves day and night, ceaselessly toiling, laboring in this busyness. He looks around him, he says, well, there's wisdom and there's busyness. There are people who live by their heads, there are people who live by their activity. Let me try to understand what's going on here. Let me look at the people in the academy, the people in the university environment. That's wisdom. Let me look at people in the business world. Busy, 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 working, working, running, running, running. Let me see if I can figure out what's going on. And the conclusion in verse 17, a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. Notice how nicely he closes this off. He says, if you labor to find out what's going on, or if you're a wise man, you just can't do it. And he makes a nice little chiasm out of this. He closes it off very cleanly. Wisdom cannot explain to you what's happening in the world. Labor cannot give you an understanding of what's going on in the world. And so verse 1 in chapter 9 forms a little conclusion to this section. It is that God determines the work of the righteous and the wise. The righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred. He's not talking about the love or hatred that we receive here, but the love or hatred that we give to others. You can't know for a given person whether you're going to love that person or hate that person until the time comes. And often in your experience, you've probably switched, haven't you? You ever had your worst enemy become your best friend? Have you ever known your best friend to become your worst enemy? We don't even know who the people are that we're going to love or hate. For the righteous and the wise, their works, they're in the hand of God. All is before them. That is, all the possibilities are open depending on how God directs. It's an interesting side note here that he doesn't say that the wicked are in and their works are in the hand of God. He doesn't blame God for the wickedness of the wicked. But he does say the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. Nothing righteous in this world ever happens by the merit or strength of man. If it happens, it's because God arranges for it to happen. So man cannot know. He cannot understand what's going on in the world. Furthermore, he cannot do. He can't actually change the way the world works. Now, this section is much larger than one we just studied. It goes from chapter 2 down through verse 12. And there are three major pieces to it. There are two pieces that say you can't make a difference. One of those is 2 through 6. And the second one is down at the end. Verse 11 and 12. And then in the center, there is a positive section that says, in the light of this, in the light of not being able to make a difference in the world, here's how you ought to live. Here are things that you ought to do. And it's one of those lovely oases in this book, one of those very positive sections that tells us of the blessings that God gives to us in our labor. You can find no contentment from your labor. That's the message here. You can't make a difference. But you can find contentment in your labor. And if you'll allow me to point out one further detail here, that is that these two can't make a difference sections each have the same two pieces. They have one piece that says your individual merit is irrelevant, and they have a second piece that says everybody has the same end. So the irrelevance of your individual merit and the common end that awaits all people. And so let's start with that up here at chapter 9, verse 2. Your individual merit is irrelevant. All things come alike to all. Whoever you are, there's no reason for you not to expect any experience that anybody could experience. All things, all events, all circumstances come alike to all people. There is no group of people that is immune from some set of circumstances and guaranteed to have other circumstances. That doesn't mean there may not be tendencies in the world. But he's saying as you observe life, you're going to find the wicked both suffering and prospering, you're going to find the righteous both suffering and prospering. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth as he that feareth an oath. He's calling out here moral differences between people. And he's saying they're all subject to the same events in daily life. He contrasts the righteous, that is a person who walks according to God's law, and the wicked, the person who rebels against God. They experience the same events in life. The good and the clean on the one hand, and the unclean on the other. Now he's going back to the laws in Leviticus and say you're not supposed to eat pigs, not supposed to touch dead bodies, all these laws of cleanliness, ceremonial cleanliness. Now, the Jews were very careful to mind these laws of cleanliness, and that was important. Remember Daniel and his companions? They would not defile themselves with the king's meat, and they're commended for doing that. That's the right thing for them to do. They were being clean because God had commanded those laws. And yet, the same kinds of things happen to people that keep the laws of cleanliness as happen to people that don't keep them. To him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. Now, God commands sacrifice. There were some sacrifices that were obligatory that everyone had to offer. And yet, if you looked at all the people who did sacrifice, we would say in our culture, all the people who go to church and all the people who don't go to church, the same kinds of things happen to the people who go to church and to the people who don't go to church. You know, I'd like to be able to stand up here and tell the youngsters that if you go to church, life will be nice to you, and if you don't go to church, it won't be. But that wouldn't be true. We had our friends from Turkey tell us a couple of months ago that in Turkey, the people who go to church are the ones who get locked up in jail and tortured. While in this country, oftentimes, if you're spending your Sundays in church, you're not spending them out working on your business, and you probably will end up at a disadvantage in your business life. It's simply not true that the one who sacrifices, who worships God in the right way, ends up with a temporal advantage over the one who doesn't. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he that sweareth, that is, he that swears falsely. This is used to speak of someone who abuses promises, who makes promises and does not keep them. He ends up experiencing the same kinds of things as the person who fears an oath, that is, who lives in obedience to the oaths that he has made. So, your individual merit is irrelevant as far as your experiences of daily life are concerned. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be right. We saw last time that there is payday someday, that the day is coming when God is going to balance things out. And when the righteous and the clean and the sacrificer and the good and those who honor their oaths, when those people will in fact be rewarded, that time is coming. But not under the sun. Not on this earth. Not in the scope of this present life. God may give you blessing. He may give you trials. Often the ones who are the most righteous have the heaviest trials. The great example of this is our Lord Jesus Christ, the most righteous man that ever lived. And yet no one suffered as much as he did. His visage was marred more than any man, his form more than the sons of men. All men have a common end. Individual merit is irrelevant. All men have a common end. Verse 3. This is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event to all. And now he's going to show us three things that are true of all men. First, the heart of the sons of men is full of evil. That's something that all men have in common. He does not say here, the heart of the wicked sons of men is full of evil. He says, the heart of the sons of men is full of evil. Jeremiah says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? He's not just talking about the unbelievers. Consider Paul in Romans chapter 7. The good that I would, I do not, the evil that I would not, that I do. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? I have a law in my members, warring against the law of God. The heart of the sons of men is full of evil. And each of us who is honest with himself or with herself today knows that that's true. We are a fallen race. As long as we're in these bodies, until the Lord Jesus comes back, we're going to be continually in a battle. It's hard to be righteous. It's not hard to be bad. It's hard to be righteous because the heart of the sons of men is full of evil. That's one thing that we all have in common. Righteous or wicked, clean or unclean, sacrificer or not sacrificer, good or sinner, one who lies and one who tells the truth, we're sinful people. The second thing that's true of all of us is that madness is in our hearts while we live. Do you ever feel that you're going out of your mind sometimes? I hope the youngsters don't yet, but you'll get there, don't worry. You'll face the frustrations of life. You'll feel very frustrated, very depressed. That's the common lot of all men. Life is not, we all go around smiling and everything is happy and we feel all bubbly inside. The only way to feel bubbly inside is to drink a lot of sparkling water. And even that will give you heartburn when you're done. Madness is in their hearts. There's always some degree of frustration, of depression, of stress that comes upon us. And when that's all done, after that, they go to the dead. Everybody, righteous, unrighteous, ends up dying. You see, evil in your heart, there is an immediate consequence of that evil, which is the madness of our world. And the ultimate consequence of that sin and evil is that we go to the dead. We die. Now, of these three things that all men have in common, one particularly grasps the preacher's fancy, and that is the condition of the dead. So he takes these three things. So you've got the evil in the heart, madness, death, and this one now he's going to blow up in verses 4 to 6, and he's going to talk about it in a lot more detail. Verse 4. Yes. For to him that is joined to all the living, there is hope. As long as you're alive, there is at least hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. Would you rather be a dog or a lion? You know, in the Bible, the lion's the king of the beasts, the way he is in our thought. Very powerful beast. In fact, one of the names for Jerusalem in the Bible is Ariel, the Lion of God, this great triumphant city, this royal city. The lion was seen as a majestic beast. A dog in the Bible, on the other hand, is the lowest form of life. People didn't keep dogs for pets. They ran around sort of wild in the streets. Most of them had rabies. You threw them scraps. They served a social purpose. They chased away intruders. If you didn't belong in that city, the dogs would know you and they'd chase you out of town. But they were practically wild wolves. And they were kicked and abused. When someone in the Bible wants to call himself a terrible name, he says, I'm nothing but a dog. I'm a dead dog. Well, so lions are better than dogs, right? But, Mr. Preacher says, a living dog is better than a dead lion. If you have a choice of being a dog or a lion, but if you're a lion, you're going to be dead, and if you're a dog, you're going to be alive, which would you rather be? I'd rather be alive and be a dog at the very lowest thing that there is on earth than to have the very highest stature, be a lion, but be dead. And now he'll show us why by focusing in on the condition of the living and the dead. Verse 5, the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward. The living at least can think about what comes beyond the grave. They can look forward to what happens on the other side of death. Look forward to maybe a bad word, but they're conscious of what's going on. The dead, on the other hand, two things are said about them. They don't know anything, and they don't get anything. The dead know not, and they receive no reward. Now, I'm going to put those two up here because we have to talk about them for a moment. They don't know anything, and they don't get anything. This verse has been picked up by the Jehovah's Witnesses in support of their theory of soul sleep. The notion that when you die, you are obliterated. You're unconscious. You're gone. No suffering, no happiness, no nothing. See? It says right here in the Bible, the dead know not anything. Well, I would suggest to you that we shouldn't stop in the middle of a verse. We shouldn't stop in the middle of a paragraph. He tells us here two things about the dead. They know not and they get not. And then we have the word for toward the end of verse 5. You see it? For. Now he's going to explain what he's just said about the dead not knowing and not getting anything. For the memory of them is forgotten. Nobody remembers them anymore. Also, their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished.
neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. Now these are his explanation of what it means for the dead not to know anything and not to get anything. They know nothing. They have no reward. What do I mean? Well, they have no reward. The memory of them is forgotten. Nobody comes and remembers them and says, oh, you did so wonderful, and gives them a pat on the back. People who die are soon forgotten. Their good deeds, forgotten. No more praise, no more reward for what they've done. And at the end of verse 6, we have that same idea. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. Perhaps a man sets up a great business firm, and then he dies. Do they send dividends to him in the grave? Can he still enjoy the profits from his business? Maybe someone works very, very hard. We're building a model right now. I think you know, Gene and I are building a model airplane. Boy, we're looking forward to flying that airplane. If we were to die, would we be able to enjoy flying the airplane? No. No reward to the dead. Okay, well, that makes sense. The dead don't get anything. That is to say, no one remembers them in this life. In this life, they have no share in the things that are done, the things that they've worked toward, they cannot benefit from. How about this other section? They know not. I'll suggest to you that just as the end of verse 5 and the end of verse 6 talk about get not, the first part of verse 6 describes what he means when he says the dead know not. That is, their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. All the love that they loved while they were on earth, they don't love anymore. The hatred that they hated while they were on earth, they don't hate anymore. The jealousies that they were involved in while they were on earth, they don't have those jealousies anymore. In fact, this is borne out by our Savior's teaching that when people die, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. That the earthly relationships, the relationships that characterize us on earth, love, hate, jealousy, all those things that occupy our minds day after day after day, are gone. The dead don't sit around thinking about, boy, I love that person so much, or, oh, I hate that guy, I'm going to get back at him, or, oh, I'm jealous, I wish I had what she had. That doesn't occupy the dead. The things that earthly people think about, dead people don't think about. Now, he doesn't make any statement here about what sorts of things beyond this life may occupy the dead. That's completely beyond his concern. What he's concerned with here is that the dead don't love, the dead don't hate, the dead don't feel jealousy. That's what he means when he says the dead know not anything. Their mental activity that they were involved in so strenuously through the years of their earthly life stops. They may well be thinking about other things, and we know from the New Testament that we indeed shall be. But their life under the sun is done. And all the thoughts that went along with that life under the sun are finished. That is the common end of all men. The common end of all men. Why don't we skip to the second you can't make a difference section here. Verses 11 and 12. And we'll see the same two things emphasized that we saw here, which is your individual merit doesn't count. There is a common end to all men. Verse 11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. Back in verse 2, we had a list of categories that didn't matter. They were moral categories in verse 2, the righteous and the wicked, the clean and the unclean. Him that sacrifices and him that sacrifices not. Now the categories are not moral, they're practical categories. They're categories that have to do with temporal life, secular life. But they don't matter either. It's not just the sacred categories that don't matter. The secular ones don't matter either. The race is not to the swift. Often the fastest person may stumble and fall. Remember the speed skating trials in the Olympics? When America's absolute top contestant, the fellow who had swept the world contest just a few weeks earlier, in the lead on two races, fell. He didn't lose because he was slowest. He was the fastest one there. Everyone could see that. He was well in the lead, but he didn't win because he tripped and he fell. The race does not belong to the swift. The battle does not belong to the strong. The British Empire was very strong at the time of the Revolutionary War. The colonies were disunified, just a bunch of hicks, farmers, not properly armed or equipped in any way, and yet the United States won the Revolutionary War, not the British. Neither yet bread to the wise. You may know the answer to the world's problems. Someone else may steal your answer or make a lot of money, and you may end up starving to death. And the same thing, nor yet riches to men of understanding. In fact, this is the great paradox of the university. People often talk about the poor university people. University professors get these great ideas, and the only way they can enjoy those ideas is to leave the world of wisdom and go into business for themselves. Those who have the most wisdom, the most understanding about a given domain, often don't make the money off of it. They don't profit from it. Nor yet favor to men of skill. Now the word for favor here is the goodness that a superior shows to an inferior. And so here the picture is manager of a household, owner of a house with a bunch of servants. So one servant is very, very skillful. Maybe this is the servant who's responsible for making shoes for the family. Or perhaps the servant who's responsible for cooking meals for the family. And yet how often that skill is not appreciated and it's not rewarded. The one who is in a position to reward it doesn't. Favor often does not come to the man of skill. Instead, time and chance happen to them all. I think maybe this phrase, time and chance, is an example of what we saw the other day in another context, what I call the hendiadys, two words that join together to form a single word. You know, time in the Bible doesn't always mean the passage of the movement of the hands on your clock. We think of time as the movement of hands, but time often means occasion or circumstance. And I think that may be what is involved here. Time and chance. Accidental circumstances. I had a phrase for it here. Unexpected occasions happen to everybody. He goes on to amplify that in verse 12. Man knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them. You see, the occasion comes upon them unexpectedly, and they're trapped. The ultimate example of this is death. Who can tell the hour of his death? We can't. We're never ready for it. It always takes us by surprise. Those of us who've had the death of loved ones, we know how much it takes us by surprise, and certainly takes them by surprise too. Time and chance happen to all men. You see, this is the same point that was made back here in verse 6. Ultimately, death comes and swallows us up. Whether we are fast or slow, strong or weak, wise or stupid, skillful or clumsy, time and chance happen to them all. You can't make a difference. You cannot guarantee yourself happiness by working hard, by being smart, by going to school. You might increase your chances. I hope you do work hard. I hope you do become smart. I hope you do go to school. There are reasons for doing that, but the reason for doing that is not the one you might expect. It's not, if I do this, I'm going to be happy, because you might not be happy. Time and chance happen to all men. But why should we do it then? Let's go back to the middle of this little chiasm, the section I marked with a plus sign here, verses 7 through 10. These verses give us three exhortations. With each exhortation, there is a motive. Do something because this is the case. Do something because this is the case. Do something because this is the case. First exhortation, verse 7. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart. For God, the Authorized Version says, now accepteth thy works. That's a little bit misleading. It sounds as though he didn't 2 days ago, but now he does. In fact, the Hebrew word there is perhaps more accurately rendered already. God has already accepted your works. As a saint, you are in good standing with God. God sees your righteous actions. He's not waiting till you get to the end of the life of your life to see if you succeed. He knows you. He has accepted your works. Relax in his presence. Eat your bread with joy. Drink your wine with a merry heart. So we're thinking here of our relationship with ourselves. We should be at peace with ourselves, knowing that God has already accepted us in the Lord Jesus Christ. He has forgiven our sin. There's no reason for us to sit around and feel guilty or lambast ourselves. God's portion for us is to relax, enjoy his favor, enjoy the gifts that he gives to us. Now, eating and drinking are things we do by ourselves. The next exhortation has to do with our family. And there are three specific exhortations in this section, with one motive after all three of them. Let thy garments be always white. Let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with not the wife, but a wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity. White clothing means that your clothing has been washed. Oil on your head is the putting olive oil on the head to make the hair shiny and soothe the skin in a dry climate. And enjoy life with a wife whom you love. He's not saying take your wife and live with her. He is saying don't be afraid to have a wife and to live in a married relationship. In other words, he is opposing celibacy. He is opposing here asceticism. Wear white garments, nice clean clothes. Put oil on your head. Anoint yourself. Don't be in mourning. The opposite of each of these things is a sign of mourning. Clothes covered with ashes, not putting ointment on the head, the celibate attitude that says, I'm not going to be involved with the marriage relationship, I'm going to live single and just dedicate myself to the Lord. He says, to deprive yourself that way, thinking that's going to please God, no, that's not what I want. I don't want you to live in mourning. I want you to live in a state of joy within your family circle here. Don't go living as though all of your family had just dropped dead. And the motive, that is thy portion in this life and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. Living in joyful family relationships is part of the portion that God has given to us. That's what he wants us to enjoy. We shouldn't be depriving ourselves of that, thinking that if we beat ourselves over the head hard enough, that God will be pleased with us. And Paul echoes this too. He talks about the false teaching which will lead people to refuse marriage and will lead people to deny meats that God has created to be enjoyed with thanksgiving. So once again, we see that he is right in line with Mr. Preacher here. Live in a state of joy in your family. Don't go around mourning all the time. Enjoy family life. That is your portion in this life. That's what God has given you to enjoy. So you should enjoy it. Now there's a third exhortation, and that's in verse 10. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. I told you there was a reason to go to school, and there was a reason to work hard, and here it is. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. Just get in there and really do it. For there is no work, nor device, planning, thinking, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. You know, some people in this world reach the same conclusion that Mr. Preacher does about how you can't make a difference. You can't actually improve your lot by wisdom or by hard work. And they conclude, I won't do anything then. I'll go sit on a mountaintop in rags and just sort of do nothing. I'll dissolve into nothing. And Mr. Preacher says, are you crazy? You are now preferring to be a dead lion rather than a living dog. You forgot what I said about the dogs and the lions a minute ago. That's what the grave is like. You sit there and you don't do anything. You don't work. You don't labor. You don't learn. Are you going to die right now? Are you so short-sighted that you would rather be a dead lion than a living dog? You are alive. Part of life is learning and studying and working. That's how God has made us to be. So whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Not because you're going to make yourself rich or because you're going to make yourself happy. No, that's false. But do it because that's the job God has given to you. That is God's purpose for you. Do it not to serve yourself, but to serve God. If you do it to serve yourself, you'll be disappointed because you can't make a difference. But God has given it to you. That's what it means to be alive. Therefore, do it. fulfill your destiny by the very act of living and working and striving. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might.
Because the day is coming when you can't do anything.
So this is his argument. Men cannot know, and men cannot do. We cannot figure out or understand the world that we live in, and we can't guarantee that we will make ourselves happier by our efforts. Yet in spite of all that, we are to labor, we are to work. That's the way God has made us. So we work out of obedience to Him, not out of a selfish desire to advance ourselves. After all of this talking down about wisdom, now in the next chapter he's going to go into wisdom in more detail. He's going to tell us the benefits of wisdom. And so there's a little transition here, verses 13 through 16. Consider this little story, and you'll understand perhaps a bit better why, in spite of what we've read here, wisdom is still a good thing and folly is still a bad thing. Verse 13, "This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city and few men within it." Just a tiny little town, if you please. The wall wasn't very tall, and it wasn't very thick, and they didn't have cannons all around the towers. "And there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it, walls all around of it, to keep the people from coming out and getting food. Now, there was found in it, in this city, this little city, this weak city, there was found a poor wise man." And we know that there are poor wise men. We read back in verse 11 that bread does not come to the wise. He was a poor wise man. "And he, by his wisdom, delivered the city." He figured out a way to get rid of that big, strong king so that the city was not destroyed. "Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I," you know, wisdom is better than strength. "Wisdom overcame the might of the army. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard." He never benefited from it. Wisdom is good. Wisdom is better than strength. Wisdom is the way to go. We should seek to be wise, because that is how we will best serve God. We should just remember, though, that there's no guarantee that we ourselves will profit from our wisdom. We may be like the poor wise man here. We may deliver the city. We may deliver our country by our wisdom. And yet, we ourselves may not profit. Do you see how he's really forcing us to ask, why are we working? Why are we being wise? If our motive is to serve ourselves, we will be frustrated, because we cannot guarantee that our work will bring us happiness. Time and chance, unexpected circumstances happen to all men. But if we are wise and we work hard in order to please God, then we will be useful tools in His hand, and the benefits will be felt by those around us. As we close, let's sing in our blue binders in the second section, "How Vast the Benefits Divine Which We in Christ Possess." It's a hymn that reminds us that we owe nothing to ourselves in our own efforts, everything to what God has done for us in His might and in His power.